Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. The green scum that covers our lakes in summer may soon become Mother Nature's prodigal son. Scientists at the Alberta Research Council and other organizations within InnoVentures Canada believe they can use algae to capture carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and produce biodiesel. And if you can't lose weight, it might not be your fault. Nutritional sociologist Dr. Kim Rain says your cultural and physical environment may be to blame. And the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research has launched a new study to determine the link between nutrition, pregnancy, and depression. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The scum of the earth may soon turn out to be its savior. Pond scum, that is, the lowly algae. That's the hope of scientists working with InnoVentures Canada, a consortium of research councils across the country. One of those scientists is Dr. John Vidmar, program leader for Bioresource Technologies at the Alberta Research Council.
Well, we're looking at algae as a mechanism, or the use of algae, to capture CO2 and make biodiesel and other added value products. Canada produces quite a bit of CO2. We do have a lot of point sources where we have concentrated CO2. Now, the question is, can we grow algae fast enough and that it has a good profile for these added value uses, high fatty acids for biodiesel, in an economic way?
But why algae? What makes it a candidate for this sort of work?
Well, if you start looking at our agricultural lands in Alberta or in Canada, we don't want to take those lands away from food production because food is always going to be important to us. So when you start looking at growing algae in large ponds, hectare sizes, you don't want to be using prime agricultural land. And also the productivity. On our initial calculations, we think we can get probably up to about 5 to 10 times more biodiesel in the same amount of space as we would from canola.
Where then does algae fit in the carbon cycle? Because it must be taking in carbon then.
Yes.
How does that actually work?
Well, as a green organism, it has a photosynthetic apparatus. So CO2 is transported into the cell, and then it gets converted or fixed to carbohydrates, and then other pathways down within it will convert it to sugars, to fatty acids, to the backbones of proteins, that type of situation.
What do you have to do then to make the algae work on a scale that's going to accomplish something in terms of capturing carbon or producing biodiesel?
Well, it's actually increasing their growth rates, and we're not trying to change the algae. We're trying to look for the right algae that has a fast growth rate and also has a nice oil profile for the production of biodiesel.
So in terms of strains, what are you looking at? What's the right algae?
This project started about 6 months ago, and we're on the initial parts of this. So we've actually gone to a number of different sites in Saskatchewan next to coal plants and actually sampled. And we're currently, those samples were enriched in Saskatchewan at the SRC. Then the samples actually went to Quebec, where we've done purification of the strains. And now we're looking at the growth rates to see if there's ones that are good candidates within this.
So then are these essentially like algae, the pond scum that we find on all those little sloughs around Alberta?
Exactly. When you start looking at what's available from other scientists, most of the algae, microalgae availability is tropical algaes or algaes that won't suit the temperatures that we're looking at growing these at. We're looking at 14 degrees because we know a lot of power plants, they have excess heat, they use cooling ponds. So we're looking at something that has good productivity around 14 degrees and will, live in our climate.
What are the technical challenges that you're dealing with now? What are you doing in the lab?
Well, right now we're trying to identify and we're looking at the growth rates and actually the fatty acid profiles and carbohydrates and also the protein to see how these microalgae are actually separating their carbon. Where are they putting their carbon? Because we want ones that have, you know, in excess of 50% fatty acids. So that's what we're currently doing right now. It's very preliminary at this stage. But, you know, there's been a lot of work done all over the world on this. And there's a number of actual engineering issues. You know, when you're looking at all this algae being grown in liquid, how do you separate it? Then how do you process the algae to get your oil out of it? Because it's a very watery type solution with some algae in it. So those are some of the questions we're looking at. And then from this algae, how do we process it to make biodiesel?
So is that where the fatty acids come in?
Yes. The fatty acids are the backbones, which then get converted through a number of chemical processes to produce biodiesel.
When it comes to the point where you would actually have these little algae factories around the country, is it going to be an outside thing, or is this something that would be done inside in a factory? How would it work? Are we going to have ponds everywhere?
Well, the thing is that there's a number of different technologies out there. The initial work done in the United States by the DOE used these open pond systems in which evaporation is a problem, and you also have very little control. The major push going on in the States and around the world are these bioreactors, different bioreactors in which you basically grow algae, but then the cost becomes too high because you have all this infrastructure going in. So we're actually looking at a hybrid of these covered ponds in which we have control, a lot more control on evaporation and temperature. Also, the depth of the ponds. If you're looking at a pond, the first 2 inches is the only place where you actually have your algae. Within it, underneath that, there's no algae being grown because light isn't getting there. So we're looking at solar collectors and actually trying to increase the depth of the pond where we have active growth of the algae. And that's being handled in Manitoba. We have a researcher there who's looking at lighting options and solar collectors. Because, you know, when you start looking at the magnitude of this, the amount of CO2 we produce, if we can only get growth in the first, 10 centimeters of our ponds, we're going to have all these massive ponds where we only have that ability of looking at a two-dimensional system. So one of the ideas was actually changing that and bringing it into a three-dimensional system in which we can get the light deeper into the ponds and therefore have deeper ponds and hence more productivity.
So is it based just on sunlight, or would you have to use additional light?
We're calculating that. You know, we don't have a, you know, if you start looking at Alberta, we get good light for 6 months of the year, and then we become light limited when winter comes. So, the question is, do we get, by adding additional light, artificial light, do we capture the productivity that we need for the biodiesel? And that's one of the questions we're asking, and hopefully we'll have an answer soon.
I know we have seasonal light, but do we get enough light during that time? Does it make a difference if there's direct sunlight or indirect light?
Well, you know, one of the things is that, you know, at noontime, if you look at most plants, they've actually shut off most of their photosynthetic activity because of that direct sunlight. There's a thing called photoinhibition, in which too many photons actually are hitting the photosynthetic apparatus, the antenna, and therefore they have to shuffle it, and they basically shut down photosynthesis. And this happens in a lot of tropical countries. One of the advantages we have in Alberta or in Canada is actually a lot of our light is not direct sunlight. It's always at an angle because of the latitude that we live at. There is that advantage. The other thing is that if you start looking at the amount of light we get in Alberta, I'll use Alberta as a specific case, during a whole year, we're actually doing very, very well. So, you know, those are some of the advantages. The disadvantages is the temperature. So a lot of coal-fired plants actually have excess heat. Can we trap that heat and use that to warm our pools? The other option is using geothermal heating or solar heating. So there's a number of different options here. And we're trying to integrate this to make it work. You know, 10 years ago, you know, we're looking at $10 a barrel for oil. Now, we're looking at $100 a barrel for oil. So a lot of things that weren't economically feasible, you know, that balance changes. And the other thing is that it's a win situation. We're capturing CO2, we're producing a renewable energy source. Like solar power, you have solar panels. Well, you have to think of this pond scum as actual solar panels. You know, they're taking up the sun and they're producing an energy source.
What do you think the potential is then for offsetting what we're doing now? Is it going to be a small percentage or a large?
It really depends. You know, as a scientist, I don't know what the answer is. You know, there's a number of different technologies out there, from capturing, from using trees as fuels. There's so many things. I think that every little solution we have helps the situation. You know, it's like there is going to be no silver bullet to this. Hopefully silver buckshot.
What do you like about this?
The thing that really interests me is that I have the ability to make a difference. And that's one thing as a scientist, you know, you want to make a difference. You know, you want to help society. So that's my major goal out of this.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
That was Dr. John Vidmar, Program Leader for Bioresource Technologies at the Alberta Research Council. ARC is a founding member of ICANN, or InnoVentures Canada, a consortium of research councils across the country. If you keep losing the battle of the bulge, don't blame yourself. The real problem could be the world around you. Society has changed, and in the words of Dr. Kim Rain, today's social and physical environment is obesogenic. Kim studies the sociology of nutrition, and she's the director of the Center for Health Promotion at the University of Alberta.
Well, we've seen the rates of obesity go up very quickly in the last 20 years. It's probably apparent that our genetic makeup hasn't changed in a 20-year period. Our behaviors have. We are eating more. We are exercising less. But I think even more fundamental, we don't make those behavior changes in a vacuum. Our society has changed. We are living in a society that promotes overeating and that promotes being sedentary. And so it's the ways in which that society has changed that we're trying to explore, but even more importantly, how can we change those things to make it easier to attain a healthy weight?
How do you go about finding out those things, determining what those factors are?
That's a really good question. We've started off with an extensive review of other studies that had been done in the area. And basically what we've found out is there are a variety of things that have happened in the physical environment. Physical environment is things like just the way our cities are structured. Our cities are structured more for vehicle traffic than for walking or cycling. It's becoming much, you know, more difficult to walk safely to work or school. Our schools, for example, are not even being built in new neighborhoods. Kids are being bused into established schools. So things like that have changed. Also in our economic environment, one of the things that we noticed is that obesity tends to cluster in lower income and lower education categories. It seems kind of counterintuitive, because you would expect if you had a lower income, you would eat less. So one of the things that we wanted to do is explore, well, why might that be? And some of the research that we have done has shown things like clustering of fast food restaurants in lower income neighborhoods. So people are more exposed to sort of high calorie, high energy dense, not necessarily the most nutritious foods. Some of the other things, some of the other environments are, you know, even policies, the political environment. I know when I was growing up, I'm not that old, there were no such thing as pop machines in our schools. And we've become almost dependent upon the revenue from things like pop machines in schools to pay for day-to-day functioning and books and that sort of thing. So that's a policy that's happened at a local level, and perhaps even a policy of a broader cutback in funding to the education sector that has influenced. So what we're trying to do is look in a systematic way at how some of these things are happening and where there are opportunities to intervene.
Well, in a sense, then, we've created what you might call a toxic environment that leads to obesity. Is that correct?
Definitely. Actually, Dr. Kelly Brownell, who's quite a well-known researcher in the U.S., has coined that term, a toxic environment. And so our environment is promoting obesity. It's obesogenic.
You have quite a wide variety of specialties on your team. What are some of those? Who are you pulling in?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. This is a complex problem. It's not a simple matter of, you know, we should eat less and exercise more. So not one single person can really do the research necessary to get the big picture of how things are happening. So, I mean, my background is in nutrition, but in the sociological side of nutrition, you know, as opposed to what happens to the food once it's in your body. I have colleagues on our team that have backgrounds in physical activity and physical activity behavior and what influences that. We have a geographer on the team. So it seems kind of strange, but geographers are interested in how place influences your health. And so things like the way our environments are structured is definitely a geography issue. We have anthropologists on the team. Our anthropologists are helping us to explore how culture has, you know, changed. From a couple of perspectives, one in more of an obvious perspective, such as, you know, we have a higher immigrant population. Well, what's happening to people when they come from other countries? Are they also becoming obese? Yes, indeed they are. But also, I mean, on a more general level, basically over the past 20 years, our culture has changed. It's a more obesity promoting toxic culture. So that's the anthropologist's purview. We have psychologists to explore how these environmental issues affect our psyche and how that might, you know, be motivating our choices. We have a political scientist who helps us to analyze the policies and figure out how policies have changed over time and how that might impact these things.
Well, one of the shifts, too, has been in perspective. We used to look upon obesity as being an individual's mm-hmm. problem, like, well, you're just not doing enough to take mm-hmm. care of yourself. Whereas now, that seems to have moved more into a societal problem. Why is that? And how will that change your research and your perspective?
I'm actually hoping that some of our research has helped to move that perspective. Ultimately, individuals are the people who choose whether or not to walk, or they choose whether or not to put something in their mouth. But when your choices are limited by what's available, then obviously it goes beyond an individual's choice. So we may think we have free choices, but they're not as free as we initially may think on the surface. So I look at it in a very positive light when I see it moving towards looking at more of the societal solutions as well as problems, in that, you know, it doesn't blame the victim. It doesn't put all of the responsibility on the person for their less than ideal choices. It helps to make an environment that supports people in making their choices. So I think that in order for change to happen, we need to have changes on multiple levels. It's not just a matter of teaching people how to cope with this environment that we've built.
So are you just looking in the Edmonton area?
No. I mean, a lot of our sort of smaller projects are indeed in Edmonton area. For example, one of my graduate students mapped out where all the fast food restaurants were in the city of Edmonton, and then he compared where they were to the census tract information around income, and found that people in low-income neighborhoods were exposed to 2.7 times more fast food outlets. That's just one of those numbers that rolls off the tongue. But so that type of, that helps to demonstrate that, you know, this is indeed happening locally. But we are looking at a much broader scale as well, such as, you know, one of the projects we're currently involved with is actually an international project where we're looking at advertising to children. And so what we've done is that the Canadian arm is that in several provinces in Canada, on a given number of days in January, weekend before Super Bowl, we actually taped all children's programming on a select number of channels from 6 a.m. till 10 p.m. every day for 4 days. And what we're in the process of doing now is looking at the advertisement and what are those advertisements for when it is food or exercise or physical activity related. Is it a positive message? Is it a negative message? You know, so we don't have the results of that yet, but this is a study that's actually based out of Australia. There are participants in multiple countries, and it'll give us a baseline of, you know, well, okay, such and such a country, such as Sweden, for example, has regulations on advertising to children. So does the province of Quebec, interestingly enough. Do they have, you know, different levels of obesity than the provinces or countries that don't? So we're participating in a much larger scale than just Edmonton.
When you're looking at a broad range of factors, everything from the food and nutrition to economics and policies that government makes, what can you expect to come out of this research in terms of changes or recommendations for change?
That's really the whole purpose of the research. I mean, it's one thing to understand how it works, but the reason that we want to understand how it works is so that we can make change. I think what has happened in the last few years is that people have said, oh my gosh, this is a really big problem. Let's do something about it. Let's, for example, ban vending machines in schools. Well, is that actually a reasonable thing to do? Would we expect that to solve the obesity problem? And so what our research can do is say, okay, that may help, but it's unlikely to solve the entire problem. So don't feel that it is a disappointing outcome when you don't see obesity rates go down rapidly among kids, if that's the only thing you do in schools. So let's look at what else you can do in schools. And so we can look at the collective efforts, and we, you know, so our research can look at the little pieces and see what the impact is, and then also look at collectively, okay, so let's not just look at vending machines, but let's have a healthy food policy in the cafeteria. Let's have, in Alberta, they've instituted daily physical activity as a policy across the province. Let's look at putting nutrition and physical activity into the curriculum. And what is the combined effect of all of those things? And so it helps us to advise as to what to expect, where some promising interventions might be, or where it might not be particularly popular, so maybe we should wait on that until the public is ready.
Thank you very much, Kim.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Dr. Kim Rain, director of the Center for Health Promotion Studies and a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Alberta. Her research is supported in part by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. Depression during pregnancy is on the rise. Recent statistics indicate about 12% of pregnant women will either be diagnosed with or seek medical help for depression. That's where APRN, or Alberta Pregnancy Outcomes and Nutrition, comes in. This is a new study funded by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. It will follow 10,000 pregnant women in Edmonton and Calgary, documenting the nutritional status of these women to establish what links there may be to their mental health. Dr. Catherine Field is a professor of nutrition at the University of Alberta and one of three principal investigators with the study.
The project involves 12 different researchers, and it is a new approach for Alberta Heritage to fund a large team of researchers who bring different expertise. We have everything from biostatisticians to people who look at infant development, of course our psychologists and our nutritionists looking at the two main outcome measures. But it is a really large group, and it crosses about 4 or 5 different departments between the two universities.
How are you going to manage keeping everybody coordinated?
Well, that's what we're just starting now, is the management. Since we heard that we were going to be funded in December, the core team has been meeting weekly by conference call, and the larger team biweekly by video conference between the two universities. And we're just starting to put together subcommittees and how we're going to run this project.
Now, the project itself, you're looking at the maternal health and nutrition and then the result of these children that come afterwards. Why are you interested in that? What's the problem behind it?
The main problem that has been happening is that the number of diagnosed pregnancy or depression during pregnancy has increased. In fact, the stats are saying about 12% of women during their pregnancy will be diagnosed or seek some medical help about depression, which means that because it's mental health, that means there's a lot of other women who are probably suffering from it for short periods of time and aren't diagnosed or don't get medical help. There's a growing body of literature suggesting that nutrition, both nutritional intake and nutritional status, and even things like body weight gain during pregnancy, can influence mental health, which of course can also influence what the mother's eating if they're suffering from some level of depression. And we really don't know that association, and it's fairly new area. Even though we have animal type studies looking at very biological, there's no group in Canada looking at this, and there's actually no group in North America looking at mental health and nutrition. So it's a growing problem, and we're hoping we can identify some associations, because this is a cohort, a more observational study, that we can then later go to intervention studies.
With your area of research then, what is it that you will be contributing to this project or will be looking for?
Well, I'm leading the nutrition team, which has four other nutritionists involved in it. My role is two parts. One, to help with the group that's looking at nutritional intake assessment, trying to estimate what the women are eating during pregnancy and estimate what the children are eating, so if they're being breastfed or when weaning foods are introduced or formula introduced. But my personal expertise is looking at the nutritional status, so we will be asking the mothers to give us a small blood sample at the entry when they're first confirmed pregnancy, being pregnant, and then twice more during each of the gestations of pregnancy, and then in the post-pregnancy period. And we will be looking at those to look at very specific indices of nutrient status. And our focus is very much on the micronutrients, the very small nutrients, the vitamins, minerals, and the omega-3 fatty acids that these women have in their diet and what indices we have of status.
Based on what you know from previous work, can you speculate at all as to what areas might be fruitful for you in what you're looking at, what you hope to find?
Well, since there's so many nutrients we'd like to look at, and this is, at the moment, a five-year funded project, we're focusing down on what we call the nutrients, our tier one nutrients, or the nutrients that there's the most evidence that they may be related to mental health and infant neural and neural development. And these are the omega-3 fatty acids, iron, and folic acid status and the related B vitamins. So that would be B12, vitamin B12 and vitamin B6. And so our initial is to focus in on a mineral, fatty acid, and a vitamin, a group of vitamins that work together. But we certainly are storing samples and collecting information to look at a much wider group in the future.
Well, those particular things, what role do they play in the body?
Those nutrients have essential functions that are important in other aspects of infant and maternal health. And our recommendations have really been based on those functions, not on mental health functions. And so that the need for these may be quite different to support optimal mental health. So if we look at the omega-3 fatty acids, are very important in both infant and maternal brain function, in brain development and function. They're in very high concentrations in the brain. And we know from animal work, if they're insufficient in the diet, we have effects on learning and effects on normal brain development. There's also quite a lot of work in the mental health area on omega-3 supplementing them, not so much in depression, but in other related mental health disorders. The iron is very important for some of the signals in the brain, And we know in children, if there's insufficient iron, that there's effects on learning behavior. But that's really been done in older children. But iron is really one of our classical brain nutrients. And the B vitamins are also very important in both the development of brain cells, but also in the optimal function of brain cells. So we pick the nutrients where we know they play the, we know there's a very well-established role in brain function, both in infants and in adults.
Well, when you look at the population in general, are we deficient in these nutrients?
That's an excellent question, and that is one of the reasons we also pick these three as omega-3 fatty acids, because at the moment our major source, although there's some new sources now available in the market, have been the fatty fish. We live in Alberta, and we don't have an ocean right beside us, and it's a fairly expensive food. It's also a food that there may be some concerns about toxicity, and that the consumption has been some recommendations have been made to limit those sorts of sources during pregnancy. So the omega-3s, yes, I'd say that we, in Alberta, all of the data that we have say that we may not be consuming a sufficient amount. Iron is worldwide and in North America is one of the key nutrients where there is concern in women of childbearing years and in infants, anemia and other signs of insufficient iron status are clearly evident in North America, even in affluent parts of the population. And the B vitamins are a really interesting one, particularly folic acid. And folic acid, we've now supplemented our white flour with folic acid because of the effect on neural tube defects in children. And there's concern now that we may be, by some groups, that maybe we're not putting enough in, and that there's large recommendations for supplementation with folic acid during pregnancy. There's other groups that say maybe that's too much. So we are going to have the opportunity to look at that, because many of our women will be taking quite large supplements once their pregnancy is confirmed. And we'll be able to actually look at status, and that hasn't been done in women, as well as looking at our infants. And we will be monitoring any kind of infant disorder, such as neural tube defects.
Have you found your pregnant mums yet?
That's a little way off. There's lots of pregnant mums. The pregnancy rate in Edmonton and Calgary in birth rate is been the highest. Last year was the highest ever recorded. So we have a large population out there potentially, but there's a lot of planning still to do, as well as it needs to be reviewed through ethics committees. We need to set up the process in the different centers where women will be coming to have their pregnancy diagnosed and confirmed, so that we are hoping to start next September. So I think that the moms that we'll have in our study, they maybe are just thinking about getting pregnant, or maybe not. So it won't be till next fall. Then we'll be going out there to get women to participate in our study.
Thank you very much, Catherine.
Thank you very much, Cheryl.
That was Dr. Catherine Field, a professor of nutrition in the Department of Agricultural Food and Nutritional Science at the University of Alberta. She's one of three principal investigators with the APRIN study, supported by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during the program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. You can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the Alberta Research Council, Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the University of Lethbridge, and the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Crutcher.